If you would please turn to Ezekiel chapter 3. And one other thing about that is that if you'll notice throughout this lectureship, we've been following pretty much in chapter by chapter sequence. This is way out of sequence. But that was, again, partly because of Brother Garland's travel requirements. And so we were able to put that in this time slot. But anyhow, we will deal with this. That's not a problem. We look in this chapter, and this is really part of the continuation from chapters 1 and 2 leading into chapter 4. All of this pertaining to the preparation for Ezekiel to carry out the mission that God would give to him. We see some of the imagery associated with this, with the scroll that God gave him. In fact, that's how it begins, with the scroll. And so with the verses 1 through 4, we see God's instruction to him to eat, fill, go, and speak. Let's just go ahead and read these verses. "Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, eat that thou findest. Eat this scroll," but this is the King James, by the way, "and go speak unto the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat that roll. And he said unto me, Son of man, cause thy belly to eat, and fill thy bowels with this roll that I give thee. Then did I eat, and it was in my mouth as honey for sweetness. And he said unto me, Son of man, go, get thee unto the house of Israel, and speak with my words unto them." Now, as I mentioned just a moment ago, that this is a continuation of some of the narrative that began in chapter 2, and that is that God told him to eat what he gave to him, and he handed him this scroll that had writing on both sides. We see that in Ezekiel chapter 2 and verse 10. The content, of course, had lamentations and mourning and woe. And the fact that it was written on both sides is significant. If you've ever looked at scrolls before, if you've ever seen how they're written on one side. And that's partly because of the nature of the writing material, the nature of the ink and so forth, and to keep it all, keep it together without rubbing off on having, if you've ever had pages in a book stick together and then you peel them off like that and some of the type on one side sticks to the other side. This is to prevent that from happening. But the idea here is not an oversight on God's part. Well, why did you write on both sides? It is the completeness of this message. Some have interpreted this to mean that there was the completeness of the message, or that there was so much to say that it required to write it on two sides. I tend to believe that it was the completeness of the message. It was something that it was so intent. God emphasizes things by repeating them over and over. And so by repeating a message once, twice, three times is something to get our attention. To write this on both sides indicates the importance, the extreme importance of this message. There's so much to that message that it was written on both sides, and that he gave it to Ezekiel to consume this, to eat this, he ate the scroll. It was written in words, and he ate the scroll. And that is one of the part of the visual impact of the message, of God giving this message to Ezekiel, and that is the idea of eating this scroll. And when we think about eating something, we think about chewing and the saliva helping break down the proteins and the molecules in the food, and then we swallow it and the digestion process continues. Our amazing body that God has created, there is a process that goes through from entry to exit, completely through this. And so the idea there of eating this scroll gives us the idea that this is not just something to read as a herald or as a town crier or something like that. Not only was Ezekiel to read this and go, but he was to internalize this, and he was to fill his whole being, this message, so that he was not just repeating words. He actually was living the word that he was giving to the children of Israel there, the targeted audience. And the sweetness of the taste in the mouth is also something that we read of in the scriptures, about the sweetness of the word. In the psalmist wrote in Psalm 119, verse 103, "How sweet are thy words unto my taste, yea, sweeter than honey to my mouth." And also in Psalm 104, verse 34, he said, "My meditation of him shall be sweet. I will be glad in the Lord." And certainly we can see and we can understand those who respect and honor the Word of God, to read and to study the Word, it is a sweetness to our souls. It is a balm to our souls. It is a comfort to us. But there's the warning and there is the hope that we have in there. And all of this is sweet because it comes from the mind of God and given to us in words that we can understand. Now, this also, the sweetness here, does stand in contrast to the bitterness that he experienced that we'll see later in verse 14. And so in verse 4, we see the conclusion of this short section here of his admonishment to go and to speak. And he was God emphasized to him the importance of get thee unto, go to that targeted audience. God did not leave him with a vague instruction. He told him precisely what to do, and he gave him precisely the message that he needed to present. In verses 5 through 7, we have what I would call a strange contrast. Let's read these verses. For thou art not sent to a people of a strange speech and of an hard language, but to the house of Israel. Not to many people of a strange speech and of a hard language, whose words thou canst not understand. Surely, had I sent thee to them, they would have hearkened unto thee. But the house of Israel will not hearken unto thee, for they will not hearken unto me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted. Now, in the verses 5 and 6, this is one of the things that God emphasized to Ezekiel as a reminder to them, or to him, rather, that these people that he is going to visit were his own brethren. These people to whom he would deliver this message were his own brethren, and they shared a common culture, a common background, and in this context here, a common language. And so, ordinarily, we would think that there should be no problem with him communicating that message. But it's easy to speak to someone who can understand the same language. We can speak to each other, we can hear and understand what we're saying. But it's the heart that ultimately will determine whether we receive or reject that message. And this is precisely what God is telling him. Anyone who has ever gone to a foreign land and have had to speak through a translator, we'll understand this point very clearly. For missionaries and for teachers, for military members and foreign aid workers, I have been to India and I've been to Taiwan, and in all those cases, I've spoken through a translator. It is a humbling and sobering experience to do that. You have to think of your message and you have to break it up into chunks that the translator can then translate so that you don't get too far ahead. It helps also if you are able to give the material to the translator beforehand so that they can go through and be able to determine certain idiomatic expressions and determine how to translate that into the language. It is not an easy process, and it is something that we have to keep this in mind. There's also a sense of being disadvantaged. At least on my part, when I spoke through the translator, I had to trust the translator to properly translate the words that I said, the meaning of the message that I was presenting. And certainly with that trust, you can carry through and work well with the individual, the translator. But here, Ezekiel, God was telling him, Ezekiel was not going to have that problem. It was the heart of the people that would be the problem. In fact, that is indeed what was the problem. When God sent prophets to lands where there would have reasonably been a language barrier to deal through, such as Jonah going to Nineveh, you would expect that. And in that case, with Jonah going to Nineveh, the people hearkened to the message and they repented. But this was not going to be the case with the children of Israel. In fact, in verse 7, we read that they were going to be the opposite. What we would expect to happen, not knowing the language, going to speak to them, and them not understanding the message, that's what we would expect. But going to people who did understand the language, we would expect them to understand and heed the message. It was actually the opposite in this case. They were not going to be an easy audience. In fact, they were the ones that rejected him. Stephen summarized this in Acts chapter 7, verses 51 through 53, how the Jews often rejected God's message. Even though they understood the words, they rejected God's message and persecuted and killed God's messengers. In fact, Stephen described this problem of the people as being stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears. They had refused to listen to the message, even though they understood the words. And also, in these verses in Ezekiel, God described Ezekiel's audience, the house of Israel, in similarly unflattering terms. In chapter 2, he describes them, verse 4, he describes them as impudent children and stiff-hearted. And then in chapter 3, here he again describes them as impudent and hard-hearted. And so here, with all of these ideas that we have in place, that we understand that God is telling Ezekiel, you go, you speak to them, but understand this. They are stiff-necked, hard-hearted, and they will not listen to that message. But ultimately, it is not Ezekiel that they would reject, but rather God himself. For when we present the message to those who can hear and understand that message, and they say, no, thank you, go away, I do not want to hear that. We should not take that personally. It can be difficult, especially depending on how the person reacts to us. When just before this we started on Saturday, I was taking door hangers out into a particular neighborhood, and I went up to one house, and the husband came forward, and I just indicated, I'm with the Church of Christ. We're hosting our lectureship. We start it tomorrow. I'd like to give this to you and invite you to come to the lectureship. And here's, on the backside, here's the schedule. And he looked and he said, please take that with you. And I said, okay, thank you. I understood exactly what he was saying. He rejected the opportunity to come hear the gospel. He rejected the opportunity to come study God's word. And that was his choice. We were not going to force this upon anyone. But when a person makes that choice, we must remember that they are not rejecting us, even though this is the face they see, and perhaps they will project their venom against God towards us. But ultimately, we must remember it is God that they're rejecting and not us. And that warning applied to them, to Ezekiel in his time, and to us today, that any message, we must validate the message. But if we reject it, it is indeed God that we're rejecting. We then move on to verses 8 through 11. And here God is, what I would say, God is showing his strength through Ezekiel by a play on Ezekiel's name. And let's read these verses. Behold, I have made thy face strong against their faces, and thy forehead strong against their foreheads. As an adamant harder than flint have I made thy forehead. Fear them not, neither be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, all of my words that I shall speak unto thee, receive in thy heart, and hear with thine ears, and go, get thee to them of the captivity, unto the children of thy people, and speak unto them, and tell them, Thus saith the Lord God, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear. God, if you will, God was trying to encourage Ezekiel to not be disheartened or discouraged at what he had just said. He said that these people are hardened of heart, they are stiff-necked, they are a rebellious house, and you will have a difficult time with the message. He even goes on later on to describe what he could look forward to as far as the reaction of these people. But here God was telling him, do not be afraid. He said, I have made thy face strong against their faces and thy forehead strong against their foreheads. This is really something of a play on the word of the name Ezekiel, which means God hardens, or another translation is that God strengthens. And so here he's telling him, you are the man. You are the man I have chosen to go and present this message. And furthermore, look to your name and draw strength from that, because even though you face opposition, you can beat that opposition. You can beat it head to head, face to face. Do not back down and continue doing this message. The word adamant is an indicator of similar to a diamond. And so we think of the hardest substance known to man that God is using to describe the hardness, the strength that he should have in presenting this message to this stiff-necked and hard-hearted people. Now in verses 10 through 11, God told Ezekiel, and this is now the third time, to speak to the people whether or not they would listen. There is an important lesson for us today. Many people are afraid to go out and perhaps speak to others about the gospel. They are afraid of being rejected. Well, the point is that we should never be afraid of being rejected. We will be rejected. God tells us we will be rejected. More people will reject the message than will receive it. That is not for us to be concerned with. What we should be concerned with is getting out and presenting the message. There are those out there who are searching for the truth, but they do not know that they're searching for the truth. They do not know exactly what they're looking for. And I can attest to that personally. When I was searching for the truth, I did not know I was truly searching for the truth. I searched everywhere, encyclopedias. I was looking encyclopedias and praying to God, as in the various denominations I was in before obeying the gospel, praying to God to lead me to the right denomination. I didn't know which one. Didn't occur to me to think, well, why is there Methodism and Presbyterianism and all these other isms, all these other denominations? It never occurred to me, why are there so many? And indeed, is there one single church? Well, God, in His providence, brought into my life, not miraculously, I'm not saying that at all, but by His providence, I met a man, Brother Don Underwood, who taught me the gospel. And then, for the first time in my life, I saw the truth written there in the pages of the scriptures, and I saw that I was lost when I thought I was saved, and I saw what I needed to do in order to have my sins washed away. And I obeyed the gospel that night, and I have not turned back since. I have not looked back since. But most people that we talk to, most people will reject the gospel. Jesus described the broad path that leads to destruction. And many will say to me, Lord, Lord, say in my name, did we not cast out demons? Did we not prophesy in thy name? And so forth. That many people will be surprised come judgment day. They thought they were saved. But there will be few that find the path to righteousness. There will be few that reach heaven. But we all who have obeyed the gospel, who are living faithful, godly lives, must get out and must present the message to those lost around us. And not be concerned about them rejecting us, but be more concerned about giving them the opportunity to obey the gospel. If they choose to accept it or reject it, it's their choice. But there are consequences for those choices. Eternal salvation for those who accept it and live the godly life according to the scriptures, or eternal punishment for those who reject the message of God. God showed his love, some of his character, in his description to Ezekiel of the people that he was facing, giving them the choice. He cares for all. And all mankind can see the manifestation of his care in his constant pleadings, even though they often reject them. The primary purpose of God's dealing with mankind is to bring glory to himself. And he does this when he displays that he is merciful and gracious and long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, Exodus 34, verses 6 through 7. And so it is up to us, his earthen vessels, to present that message to those in the world that are seeking, though they may not realize they're seeking the truth. Verses 12 through 15, we now see something of Ezekiel's evangelistic fervor. That's how I would describe that. And we read, "Then the Spirit took me up, and I heard behind me a voice of great rushing, saying, 'Blessed be the glory of the Lord from his place.' I heard also the noise of the wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them, and a noise of a great rushing. So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness, in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of the Lord was strong upon me. Then I came to them of the captivity of Telabib and dwelt by the river of Kibar. And I sat where they sat and remained there astonished among them 7 days." Now here, God provided more of the perspective that he needed in order to fulfill his mission, in order to present this message to the people. He gave, and this was in two parts. First was the strong impression of the glory of God who sent him. And then the second part of that was the first impression of the people to whom God sent him, the people that he was going to present this message. Now, we look in the passages here, and it's sometimes it's difficult to understand exactly what he meant by the Spirit took me up and the Spirit lifted me up. And there are a number of interpretations of where Ezekiel was as well as how he got to this destination. But the important points to remember is that the visions or the noise that he heard was behind him, and so he was going to another place. And the place where he was going, the captivity at Telabib at the river of Kibar, and he now was in place to present this message. In verse 14, we read about Ezekiel going in bitterness and the heat of his spirit. Now this, as I pointed out in verse 3, it was in contrast to the sweetness of the message, the sweetness as honey of the roll that he ate. But I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of the Lord was strong upon me. Now what does he mean by bitterness? It is not correct to say that he went in anger, but rather it's probably more correct to see that he was there in astonishment that the people rejected the word of God. And the bitterness of the idea that the people would hear this sweet message from God, the message of hope, but also the warnings of the coming judgment that was soon to come upon them, and that they would still reject that message. And so indeed, there's a certain bittersweet quality to that sweetness of the message, but the understanding that so many people were predisposed, if you will, by their own will to reject that message. And he went in the heat of the Spirit, implying an intensity of his spirit. He was zealous for the Lord. He ate the scroll, and as God said, fill your bowels with this message. And so he was living that message, and he went with the fervor that he needed in order to present the message in strength and in obedience to God and for this giving this message. The same kind of fervor that we need to have as we go out and as we live our lives in this world with the same kind of fervor. We must teach with the same kind of fervor. We must live and believe and do everything with the same kind of fervor that he had here, so that the world can take notice, see that there's something different about us, that we're not just saying, oh, praise the Lord, and go about our business, or say one thing during worship or Wednesday night Bible study, but then go out into the world and live a completely different life. The world sees that. You think of small children, how they notice every little thing that goes on. Well, it's not just small children that notice these things, how they imitate their parents or they imitate others. Those in the world notice these things. Perhaps at work, if you've been at work and you have stood for morality, you are very careful with the words that you choose and so forth. Pretty soon, people will notice that. And they will do things like, or they'll say things. Someone will let some profanity out of their mouth. And if they're near you, they'll say, excuse me. They'll turn to you and they'll say, pardon me for saying that. That tells you something, that they have noticed your life, that you reject the use of profanity, and various other aspects of your life shows that you are different than they are. And hopefully, as we live, as we work with our coworkers or with schoolmates or whatever, that we are showing Christ living in us. We are the lights and we are the salt of the earth. And we're showing Christ in us in a humble and loving manner without being arrogant or without adopting a holier-than-thou attitude. Again, the world notices that, and they will immediately, boom, brand you as a hypocrite. Whether or not it's true, they will still brand you in such a way. The world does this. And so we need to be mindful of that, mindful of the influence that we have on others around us. And so with Ezekiel going to the people, he went with this fervor. He was ready to deliver the message, but the hand of the Lord was strong upon him. He showed up there, and he was told to, he sat and waited. It said, I sat where they sat and remained there astonished among them 7 days. God, it was not ready or not yet time for God, for Ezekiel to deliver that message. And so he sat among them. The word astonished there is variously translated as astonished or overwhelmed or stunned. It's perhaps easiest to understand him sitting there, not sitting there stunned to inaction, but just stunned at what he saw. Speechless might be the way to put it. But God's hand was upon him, and when God said it was time for him to deliver the message, he would tell him when that was the case. In fact, that's what we have up in the next few verses. Verses 16 through 17, now God gives him the appointment. And it came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore, hear the word at my mouth and give them warning from me. So it took 7 days. Perhaps that was part of it was God's plan for him to sit and wait and to observe the people, but at the same time see their condition, their hardness of heart, and understand this. It is oftentimes better for us as we go into an area to just observe, not say anything, not do anything, but observe and see the character of or the nature of the people we're going to speak to or the conditions, the situation there. So often, brethren have blundered into something, like Liz, they say the bull in the china shop, blundered into things and start speaking when it would have been better to just wait for a few moments or wait for a day or two and recognize that there may be sensitive issues that if you speak, you may just inflame those issues and people will reject you without letting you have an opportunity to speak the message. Assess the situation and then speak. That doesn't mean compromise. That doesn't mean not speak, but assess the situation. And certainly, I believe that this is what God had in mind for Ezekiel. You see the people, but do not speak until I tell you to. And now he is. We read of the same type of thing in the New Testament. And Jesus told his apostles, just before he ascended into heaven, we read in Acts chapter 1, verses 4 through 13, Jesus told them to not depart from Jerusalem, but to wait for the promise of the Father. It was not yet time. It was not yet God's time for him to send the Holy Spirit to the apostles and for them for Peter to speak that first gospel sermon. Also, Jesus later revealed himself to Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus, and he told him, "Arise and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do." He had to wait. How many days? He had to wait 3 days, we read in Acts chapter 9, verses 6 through 9, until Ananias arrived to teach him the message of the gospel, verses 10 through 18. And so it is reasonable to understand that sometimes God delays executing his will in order that his followers might learn to trust him and wait on him. How many times have we prayed for things to take place? How many times have we prayed for someone to, for some event or for someone who's in the hospital or something, something along those lines, and yet we don't have an immediate response? We need to get over the idea of an immediate response to our prayers, and we need to learn to trust in God and wait on him and not on our time. And so here Ezekiel was ready to present the word of the Lord, but God told him, you wait, and now is the time. Now, in verse 17, God commissioned Ezekiel only among all of his prophets to be a watchman. This is where we read of this term. Now, the term watchman means to lean forward or to peer into the distance. And certainly, this is a description that is not terribly difficult to understand. If you have any knowledge of history, any knowledge of the walled cities, or if you've watched movies where they have the castles and you have the watchman with the bow and arrow on the corner of the tower or something like that, we can understand the idea here. But the purpose of the watchman's role in a fortress was to peer in the distance. That's why they're up high. You can't see very far on level ground or if there are hills in the area, but when you're set up high, you can see much farther into the distance. And their purpose was to look for approaching danger, such as an approaching conquering army, or perhaps even an approaching messenger from an army way off into the distance. And so the sooner the watchman saw the danger, the sooner, if the watchman was paying attention, the sooner then he could shout the alarm, and the sooner the king of the city could prepare the city for an attack, either prepare to defend the city or to send out his own army to meet the opposing army out into the field somewhere away from the city and to avoid possible slaughter. Also, he could send out an ambassador for appeasement under the white flag of truce, so to speak, to find out. And so I point out in the manuscript that the watchman almost literally held the lives of the city city residents in his hands, depending upon how seriously he took his duties. If he were alert, if he were professional, if he were doing his duty, then he could give the warning quickly and accurately. and thus allow the king time to prepare, allow the people themselves also to prepare. But if he were complacent or lazy and not doing his duty, he may not sound the alarm at all. He may say, don't worry about it. It's just a dust cloud in the distance. Don't worry about it. And maybe, you know, don't even think about it. I didn't see anything. There's nothing over there. Oh, what's going on in the marketplace today? You know, you're looking, you're distracted, not looking and not doing the job that you're supposed to do. He may only give a half-hearted warning and thus leave the king no time to prepare. And in either case, we have the hands of the people literally in the hands, or the lives of the people literally in the hands of this watchman. And so God then goes on to describe, using this description of the watchman for Ezekiel, and now in verses 18 through 21, he lists his duties and responsibilities and also the consequences of those duties and responsibilities. If you've ever done logic puzzles, certain kinds of logic puzzles, there's a form. It's just, you know, like it's a box with a square in the middle, making four small boxes in there. It's where you have, say, one parameter on one side and another parameter on the other, a yes and a no, and on and an off, and so forth. And when you look at each box, they combine the vertical axis with a horizontal axis. So you have a bad thing happen and a good thing happen, positive outcome, negative outcome, and so forth. And at some point, you'll have two positives or two negatives, or a positive and a negative, neither one. Those of you who are involved in computers or engineering, as I'm looking around, you can understand that. But the idea there is, he lists out four possibilities with positive or negative consequences. And let's take a look at these individuals. Verses 18 through 21. When I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou gives him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked ways to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thy hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked ways, he shall die in his iniquity. But thou hast delivered thy soul. Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, and he shall die, because thou hast not given him warning, he shall die in his sin, and his righteousness, which he hath done, shall not be remembered. But his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely die, or surely live, because he was warned. But and also thou hast delivered thy soul. I heard the timer go off, and so I will focus on this with the remainder of the time I have here. But as I pointed out, here are four options for Ezekiel, and those options similarly apply to us today. He could first warn, or he could first have the warning, but not deliver the warning to the unrighteous, and they certainly will die in their sins. But because he had the warning and did not deliver to them, God said, I will require that at thy hands. The Hebrew word translated as require means to seek, or to require, or to desire, or to extract, or to request. It is a reckoning. God will hold a reckoning for the messenger and demand answers to some very, very uncomfortable questions. Questions that we do not want to be hearing when it comes to the judgment day. Why did you not discharge the duties that I commanded you to do? Did you not know that you could have shown this sinner how to turn from his sins and to receive salvation? Do you not realize that partly because of your inaction and partly because of your failure to warn him, this man died in his sins? What do you have to say for yourself? And so if Ezekiel failed to fulfill his task when he had every ability and opportunity to do so, God would not excuse him and God would punish him. And so when we think about this, the idea of the watchman, that we have the message that we can turn the unrighteous from their sins or keep the righteous from going into sin. We have the ability and the message to turn them from their sins. But if we hold that message to ourselves and if we fail to use that message properly, God will hold us accountable for those. God will ask some very, very serious questions. And certainly, it applies to elders, it applies to preachers, it applies to all Christians. We have this message. Elders rule as they that must give account, Hebrews 13, verse 17. The apostle and the evangelist Paul wrote, "Woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel," 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 16. And so because of the special trust inherent in these positions that God has given, we who are elders, we who are preachers, have a very, very serious responsibility. But it doesn't stop there. It is for all Christians. We have been entrusted with the message of God to save the world of their sins. And we must go out and preach the word and teach the word and seek and save the lost if we are to truly hear the wonderful words in heaven, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Enter ye into my presence." I thank you for your attention. And as there's plenty more in the manuscript in the book, and I invite you to look at that. And as I always say, if I have said anything that brings questions to your mind, please come and ask me, and I'll be happy to discuss this with you from the Scriptures. Thank you very much.